reforms. So the Democrats are actually still caught in this propaganda moment where they're claiming to the public, they're lying to the public essentially, because there's decades of evidence that these meaningless reforms that they're pushing will actually not curb the size and power of the repressive bureaucracies that they're claiming to fight. And so it's very important that we focus the debate right now on changes that will actually reduce the levels of violence that these systems commit.
Well, we want to thank you so much for being with us. Alec Karatsakonis, founder and executive director of Civil Rights Corps, author of the book Copaganda, How Police and the Media Manipulate Our News. And that does it for our show. I'll be speaking Thursday, January 29th. After the screening of Steal the Story, Please at the Barrymore Film Center, a historic film center in Fort Lee, New Jersey. The film will be there at 7:30. You can go to our website at democracynow.org. Also there, Tia Lesson, the director of the film. And we are celebrating our 30th anniversary. That's February 23rd. Juan Gonzalez will be flying in. Among those there will be Whitmer Salas and Michael Stipe. Hooray for the riffraff and more. Check out our website at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
Tuned in to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming on the web at kboo.fm.
KBOO Zine, The Boo Beat, is back with a second issue, featuring KBOO's program guide, interviews with local activists and community members, spotlights on local businesses, on-the-ground reporting, and fun quizzes and crosswords. Our zine has its finger on the pulse of Portland, and you won't want to miss it. To snag a copy, visit kboo.fm/zine.
Tune in to Higher Reasoning Reggae every Sunday morning at 3 a.m. Higher Reasoning Reggae is dedicated to bringing international reggae word and sound power to the massive airing early Sunday mornings at 3 a.m. Only on KBOO Portland.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, a federal judge dismisses a lawsuit from the Trump administration seeking access to Oregon's voter rolls. Oregon salmon will have a key protection restored. And Portland City Councilors vote down a ban on foie gras. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, January 27, 2026. I'm Eric Loisch. A federal judge dismisses a lawsuit by the Trump administration trying to get access to Oregon's voter rolls. The Justice Department filed this same lawsuit against 23 states and the District of Columbia. The Trump administration first requested Oregon's full voter rolls back in July. On Monday, a judge granted Oregon's motion to dismiss. Unredacted voter rolls have detailed data like names, dates of birth, addresses, driver's license numbers, and social security numbers. States have pushed back on turning that information over, saying it would violate privacy laws. States have the information because they are each in charge of running state, local, and federal elections within their borders. The judge in the case found that the Trump administration did not meet a requirement to state their basis and purpose for trying to get voter records. Election officials across the U.S. found this move by the Justice Department alarming, especially going into the midterm elections. The Constitution states that only states and Congress have the authority to run elections. A judge in Georgia dismissed a similar lawsuit there, finding the Trump administration sued the wrong city, and a judge in California dismissed another similar suit, calling the government's request, quote, unprecedented and illegal, end quote. A court ruling has restored some key protections for Oregon's struggling salmon and steelhead. The Oregon Court of Appeals has struck down a state policy allowing dam operators to load fish into trucks and transport them around dams rather than upgrading the dams to allow them to swim by, Isabel Charlet reports.
In a victory for tribes and conservation groups, an Oregon appeals court has overturned a state rule that critics say weakened protections for migratory fish like salmon and steelhead. The 2022 rule allowed dam operators to trap and truck fish around dams instead of upgrading the structures to ensure safe passage for the fish. It was challenged by two Northwest tribes, including the Confederated Tribes of the Umatilla Indian Reservation and several nonprofits. Umatilla Tribal Chair Kate Brigham says the rule was changed without their input, and that fish need to be able to navigate the dams to support healthy populations.
It creates the natural path for our salmon to get back to their habitat. The trap and haul does not work. And so we were really pleased with the court decision to say there was lack of public involvement.
The court found the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife failed to notify tribes or the public before adopting the rule. The decision reinstates the state's long-standing requirement that barriers be upgraded so fish can swim past freely. Dam operators have contended that installing and maintaining fish passage equipment is expensive and can make dams less efficient. But research has shown the policy of trapping and trucking fish around dams has a much lower survival rate for salmon and other migratory fish like steelhead, sturgeon, and lamprey. Brigham says the Umatilla have had a strong relationship with ODFW for years, and that working together is key to restoring fish habitat for everyone in the region.
I know they're in the process of considering an appeal. We're hoping they don't do that because too much time in court when we can be working together.
Various efforts have been underway in Oregon to open up fish migration paths, and Brigham says there's still a lot of work to be done. Some dams need to be completely removed, while others require new fish ladders or other upgrades. Brigham emphasizes the Umatilla continue to fight for the U.S. government to uphold its end of an 1855 treaty that promised their traditional foods, including salmon, would be protected. I'm Isabel Charlet, Oregon News Service.
Portland City Council considers a ban on the sale of foie gras citywide. Foie gras is a dish often made by force-feeding grain to ducks, or traditionally geese, and then harvesting their livers. Policy was co-authored by City Councilor Mitch Green and Council President James Dunphy and was heard earlier today in the Arts and Economy Committee meeting. Importantly, not all foie gras is made by force-feeding, and this ban would only apply to force-fed poultry products. Under this ban, any establishment that sells force-fed poultry could be fined up to $5,000 per violation. A fine would only be imposed if the business refused to stop selling foie gras 2 weeks after receiving written warning from the city. Portland food industry experts estimate the ban would impact fewer than 10 Portland businesses. California and two other U.S. cities, Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and Brooklyn, Massachusetts, have banned the sale of foie gras. Eva Hammer, executive director of Pro Animal Oregon, a group that lobbies against factory farming, said, quote, "This ordinance is about drawing a clear line around what Portland is willing to support in its food system. Force-feeding birds for foie gras conflicts with the values this city has long stood for," end quote. Opposition has questioned the need to prioritize this ban while more pressing issues loom over the city. At a December meeting, Councilor Olivia Clark asked why the debate was scheduled to come up before a committee discussion around the city budget, which is facing a significant deficit. A proposal to move the ordinance out of the Arts and Economy Committee failed, losing 2-3. The Trump administration blames Minnesota Democrats for the pretty and good shootings. Calls grow for DHS Secretary Kristi Noem to resign, and Senate Democrats vow to block any DHS funding, increasing the odds of another government shutdown. With that story and more, it's Edwin J. Vieira with 2026 Talks.
Welcome to 2026 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
This tragedy occurred as a result of a deliberate and hostile resistance by Democrat leaders in Minnesota.
Press Secretary Caroline Leavitt and the White House are blaming Minnesota Democrats for Alex Pretty's death over the weekend. The 37-year-old Veterans Affairs nurse was shot while protesting ICE actions in Minneapolis, the second fatal ICE shooting there this month, after Renee Good was killed while driving away from an immigration agent. The administration accuses Pretty of terrorism and even planning assassinations, but videos show he was disarmed and on the ground when he was shot multiple times. The state has seen ICE raids since widespread social services fraud was, with little evidence, blamed on the Somali community. But even some strong congressional allies of the president now say ICE should leave Minneapolis. Minnesota Republican Chris Mandel is ending his campaign for governor, saying his party's national leaders have made it impossible to win a statewide election. But Vice President J.D. Vance says mistakes will always be made in law enforcement and argues local municipalities working with federal law enforcement can avoid further bloodshed.
There are some very basic things that would make Minneapolis look like Memphis, Tennessee, a blue city where you do not have this chaos in immigration enforcement because the local police and the local authorities are cooperating with us.
But data compiled by news site The Trace finds during the current crackdown, there have been 19 incidents where immigration agents opened fire and another 36 when they held people at gunpoint under questionable circumstances. National polls now show Republican voters support investigating Preddy's death, and a small but increasing number even say ICE should be abolished. 70 members of Congress have signed on to a move for the impeachment of Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem. New York Governor Kathy Hochul says Noem displays a, quote, profound disregard for human life.
Kristi Noem has referred to these peaceful protesters as domestic terrorists and lied about the shooting victims being the aggressors. She told law enforcement officers to put on masks and military fatigues to basically treat the American public as the enemy.
This comes amid a looming fight in the Senate over the DHS budget. Democrats in the chamber are vowing not to pass a package that includes it, and a partial government shutdown could begin as early as Friday unless the Senate approves a multi-agency funding bill. Last week, several moderate House Democrats broke with their leaders to side with Republicans in approving legislation with money for DHS, along with funds for FEMA and other priorities. University of Wisconsin political scientist Howard Schwaber says this could be a crisis for Democratic Party leadership.
If they fail to either stand strong and shut down the government or obtain dramatic cuts for DHS and constraints on DHS operations, I think their leadership of the Democratic Party is over.
He notes Democratic voters are dissatisfied with concessions to Republican demands. The record 2025 shutdown ended when a number of Democratic senators voted to fund the government based on promised compromises that haven't yet materialized. I'm Edwin J. Vieira for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
The American Petroleum Institute is urging Congress to put an end to state laws that hold fossil fuel companies accountable for the impacts of pollution. Climate Superfund laws have already been passed in New York and Vermont and are being considered in California, Maine, Maryland, Massachusetts, and New Jersey. As Eric Galatas reports, it's not something an oil-rich state like Wyoming is considering.
The nation's largest lobbying arm of the oil and gas industry is calling on Congress to shield companies from a growing number of lawsuits and state laws passed to make the industry pay for the impacts of pollution. The American Petroleum Institute's 2026 policy priorities include ending the expansion of climate superfund policies recently passed in Vermont and New York. Claire Dorner with the Sierra Club says these new laws simply say if you make a mess, you need to clean it up.
It isn't fair that big oil and gas companies are continuing to rake in record profits while we pay the price for pollution and lies, literally paying the price, and we need to make them pay for their damages.
Superfund laws have also been introduced in California, Maine, Maryland, Massachusetts, and New Jersey, but are not expected in Wyoming. The American Petroleum Institute calls the new laws abusive and is urging Congress to intervene to maintain U.S. energy leadership around the world. The Institute also wants lawmakers to speed up permitting processes in order for the industry to make investments they say would strengthen the nation's energy grid. But taxpayers in Wyoming and across the U.S. are already making investments in the fossil fuel industry. Tony Aguilar Rosenthal with the Revolving Door Project says as working families struggle with the rising cost of housing, groceries, and utilities, U.S. oil and gas companies currently receive over $34 billion in government handouts every year.
It's really important to not just make polluters pay for the immensity of the damage and the harm that they cause, but also to stop public subsidies, which is billions of dollars every year.
Dorner says the Institute's goal of blocking state laws that hold fossil fuel companies accountable is just the latest example of an industry kicking the true costs of climate change down the road.
They've known since the 1970s that continuing to burn fossil fuels is going to lead to disaster, and they actively lied throughout the decades to try to maintain the status quo so that they could continue making their profits.
This is Eric Galatas reporting for the Wyoming News Service.
Thank you.
are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Coast Range Radio. At 6 o'clock, it's This Way Out. And at 7, Civic Cipher. Tonight's weather will be cloudy with an overnight low of 37 degrees. Tomorrow's weather will be rainy with a high of 50. Today in history, in 1945, Soviet troops entered Auschwitz, Poland, freeing the survivors of concentration camps where over a million people were killed by the Nazis. The date is recognized as International Holocaust Remembrance Day. The quote of the day is from American writer John Updike, who wrote, quote, "A leader is one who, out of madness or goodness, volunteers to take upon himself the woe of the people. There are few men so foolish, hence the erratic quality of leadership in the world." A memorial in Arizona marks 1 year since Indigenous teen Emily Pike went missing. Her unsolved murder became a rallying cry for justice for the Mesa, Arizona area. That story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. On January 27th of last year, San Carlos Apache teenager Emily Pike went missing from a Mesa, Arizona group home. Her dismembered remains were discovered a month later in garbage bags more than 100 miles away. No arrests have been made nor suspects named. Earlier this month, a memorial in Mesa marking where Emily was last seen alive got taken down. As KJZZ's Gabriel Pietrazio reports, it's the latest rallying cry for justice in the 14-year-old girl's unsolved murder.
Who are we here for?
Emily Pike!
Then say her name!
Emily Pike!
Say her name!
Emily Pike!
Say her name!
Emily Pike!
At the corner of Mesa Drive and McKellips Road, dozens of demonstrators met on a recent Saturday as cars drove by honking their horns.
Justice for who?
Emily Pike!
Who do we love?
Emily Pike!
Who do we love?
This is where Emily was last seen alive.
Only secrets in their diary. Girls gone missing is a national inquiry.
Since her disappearance, a chain link fence hugging the edge of a 28,000 square foot vacant lot has become home to a roadside memorial for the slain Apache teen. Visitors from near and far have flocked to this bustling intersection, adorned with flowers, stuffed animals, a banner of Emily's face, and lots of red ribbons. That was until someone suddenly took everything down earlier this month. No matter who did it, Jolene Shorty is still upset.
You took down her stuff. There is a respectful way. There is a traditional way to let things go. This is not the way.
For Shorty, she says this is the second tragedy to happen there.
I see a clean slate to start over. In a way, they almost helped us. We're going to come back and put up more stuff. We're going to honor them the way we're supposed to.
Delvina Charlie, who is Dene, thinks taking down those mementos adds insult to injury.
This is the respect that we got. We're pushed to the side that our voices meant nothing, that she meant nothing. If this was a different privileged girl, it would have been handled differently.
Since the items were taken down, Emily's family has been in talks with the city of Mesa on planting a tree and placing a bench at Fitch Park, just a few blocks from her last known location. Jared Marquez is San Carlos Apache and treasurer of the Turtle Island Women Warriors.
I've been there. Being a 13-year-old kid, never talking to my parents, running around on the reservation, you know, nobody ever truly caring. And it's hard to think what this girl went through, a lot of us could have been through.
As for the investigation into Emily's murder, KJZZ asked the FBI, the Bureau of Indian Affairs Missing and Murdered Unit, and the lead agency, Gila County Sheriff's Office, for the status, but did not receive any updates. For National Native News, I'm Gabriel Pietrazio reporting from Mesa.
The National Congress of American Indians and the Native American Rights Fund are hosting a webinar titled Know Your Rights, followed by Q&A on Wednesday to provide practical guidance for tribal citizens on interactions with ICE, The organizations say it's in response to growing concerns from across Indian country. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
This year, the most famous road in America is 100 years old, Route 66. Established in 1926, it was once the main artery for drivers between Chicago and Santa Monica, California, a transformation created by the rise of America's automobile culture. Centennial celebrations are planned in communities along the 2,400-mile stretch, culminating in its official opening date, November 11, 1926. Roz Brown has more.
In 1926, U.S. Route 66 was just a road connecting the country's midsection to the West Coast, but it soon came to symbolize pursuit of the American dream. 100 years later, communities along the highway are planning centennial celebrations, including Albuquerque. Sometimes called the Mother Road, Route 66 took its place in American culture with its own song and a 1960s television drama. Former University of New Mexico professor David Dunaway has researched its history and written several books. In addition to New Mexico, he says the highway ran through 8 states.
It was cobbled together out of existing dirt and fairly primitive roads into a system that went from Los Angeles to Chicago or vice versa. We say it's a two-way road, but a one-way myth.
The mythology was so strong, other countries, including Brazil, England, Japan, and Switzerland, have had their own Route 66 societies and associations. Some 20 years after it captured popular imagination, travelers on the road tuned their radios to Nat King Cole's 1946 song, Get Your Kicks on Route 66, increasing its popularity with tourists. Albuquerque will celebrate the road's history on July 18th. By the 1950s, the interstate highway system had bypassed many of the towns along Route 66, setting off a decline of local, tourist-dependent motels, diners, and gas stations, and turning some communities into ghost towns. That's the case in New Mexico, where Dunaway says the road ran through Budville, where few residents remain, but also central Albuquerque, now the state's largest city.
Route 66 in New Mexico is a startling set of contrasts. Route 66 goes through long, wide open spaces, mesas, and dry riverbeds. It is all those things.
In addition to New Mexico, Route 66 runs through Arizona, California, Illinois, Kansas, Missouri, Oklahoma, and Texas. Dunaway is working with the National Park Service's Route 66 Corridor Preservation Program and recently completed an anthology called A Route 66 Companion.
It's been a central part of my life once I realized how important this road was, not just to Americans, but to visitors from all over the world, and probably the first one to become a destination in and of itself.
This is Roz Brown, New Mexico News Connection.
In the fast-changing controversy over Greenland, Europeans are exploring retaliatory trade options, even as Trump backs off from new tariffs and his demand to acquire the island. Lost in the dispute is Greenland's critical role in global warming, which affects mineral mining and shipping routes. As one observer notes, Trump's coercive diplomacy ensures an enduring rift in U.S.-Europe relations. Now we go to Global Citizen commentary on the issue from Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov. The opinions expressed in the following piece are those of the speaker.
Hello, everyone. The saga of Donald Trump's threats to acquire Greenland seems never-ending. A visit to Washington by Denmark's and Greenland's top leader a week ago failed to move the dial with U.S. officials. Secretary of State Marco Rubio and Vice President J.D. Vance remained adamant that, as Trump has put it, Greenland must belong to the U.S. In Congress, opposition to Trump's demand is mounting among Republicans. Senator Mitch McConnell, for instance, said, quote, "I have yet to hear from this administration a single thing we need for Greenland that this sovereign people is not already willing to grant us," unquote. A new poll by Quinnipiac found that 86% of voters oppose U.S. seizure of Greenland. But that has not stopped Trump from continuing the pressure tactics, including imposition of 10% tariffs February 1, rising to 25% June 1, on the 8 European countries that support Denmark in refusing to sell Greenland. The 8 include France, Germany, and Britain. These new tariffs will probably be added onto existing ones, 10% for British imports to the U.S., 15% for EU imports. When making the decision, Trump called himself the Tariff King, Clearly, even if the Supreme Court were to declare Trump's weaponization of tariffs unconstitutional, Trump is reportedly prepared to use other mechanisms that would have the same effect. A new trade war with Europe is in the cards. Europeans are now scrambling to come up with an effective way to respond to Trump. Their anger is palpable. Their next step isn't. It's either a trade war or a real war, one observer said. Germany's vice chancellor declared that European nations, quote, must not allow ourselves to be blackmailed by the U.S. Fine, but what to do without further antagonizing the beast? So far, the trade deal Trump and Ursula von der Leyen, president of the European Commission, negotiated last summer has been frozen. A more powerful step, favored by France, would be to use what is called the anti-coercion instrument, Europe's so-called trade bazooka. It would essentially fight fire with fire. That is, allow the European Union to engage in economic warfare, such as by imposing trade quotas and import and export restrictions on U.S. goods, and slapping limitations on big American technology companies or other service providers that do large amounts of business with Europe. But using these devices would sharply ratchet up transatlantic tensions, possibly giving Trump an excuse for further reducing the U.S. commitment to NATO and to Ukraine security. He's entirely capable of backing out of both. On the other hand, Europeans must not kowtow to Trump, who thrives on exploiting every sign of weakness. All the attention to Greenland's military value has obscured a perhaps more important reason that Greenland matters: its critical role in global warming. As of mid-2025, Greenland had lost 105 million metric tons of ice, making minerals such as graphite and rare earth in the world's largest island more accessible to pillagers like Trump. Count on him and his administration to do nothing to limit climate change and everything to extract the minerals. Greenland is sort of on an unstoppable trajectory to melt, said Sarah Doss, a glaciologist who is a scientist emeritus at the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution. The melting is also impacting global ocean currents. Sensitivity to the environment has been a hallmark of Greenland's laws. Uranium mining is forbidden and oil exploration licenses have stopped being given. The country is well aware of the potential environmental damage that will be caused as new shipping routes open due to warming. Dialogue, the usual way to work out disputes, seems not to interest the U.S. side, even though an agreement with Denmark and Greenland is within easy reach. Every time dialogue is suggested, Trump, Vance, or some other top U.S. official reiterates that the only purpose of talking is to facilitate U.S. acquisition of Greenland. It's a positive sign that Trump, speaking at the World Economic Forum in Davos, ruled out the use of force, at least for now, and he removed the new tariffs, saying he and the NATO Secretary General had reached a framework agreement. The Danes and Greenlanders apparently weren't consulted. Maybe there's an agreement, or maybe Trump retreated in the face of overwhelming criticism. The dispute over Greenland shows as clearly as day why the administration of Donald J. Trump is a disaster for American foreign policy. His disparagement of traditional allies, his refusal to acknowledge the Greenland people's self-determination, his weaponization of tariffs, his rejection of serious dialogue in favor of coercive diplomacy, these features of Trump's approach to the world have made the U.S. far less secure than would otherwise be the case. The day will come when America needs close allies by its side. As Canada's Prime Minister Mark Carney said at Davos, Trump's Greenland position has created a rupture in world affairs, with might making right and the rules-based order fading. Trump has driven Canada and other middle powers to seek friends elsewhere, giving China and Russia an unexpected and unearned gift. I'm Mel Gertoff for the Global Citizen. Thanks for listening.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, January 27, 2026. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-801-1378. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Mel Gertov and Lizard. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Isabel Charlet, Antonio Gonzalez, Eric Galatas, and Edwin J. Vieira. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Eric Leuschner. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are supported by our members. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to the number 44321. Stay tuned now for Coast Range Radio.
You're listening to Coast Range Radio. I'm Michael Gaskill. The word fascism gets tossed around a lot these days, but what does that word even mean? And what does it mean to call, for instance, the Trump regime fascist as opposed to or in addition to authoritarian or autocratic? And what about terms like ecofascism or petrofascism? So last fall, I interviewed University of Oregon professor Sarah Wald, and we touched on the term ecofascism. That sent me down a little bit of a rabbit hole on that term and the dangerous myths that many environmentalists may be unwittingly buying into. Sarah was kind enough to connect me with the Anti-Creep Climate Initiative, a collective working to expose ecofascism ideas and myths that permeate our culture and media. And maybe this sounds like an esoteric subject, but I think it has real-world importance. Because our beliefs and actions are often shaped by stories and myths and narratives that are so subconsciously ingrained in us, they become like the air we breathe. So to talk about all of this, my two guests today are two of the co-founders of the Anti-Creep Initiative, co-presidents of the Association for the Study of Literature